I'm Duarte Geraldino. You're listening to The Takeaway. Who gets to vote? That question was supposed to have been decided by the Voting Rights Act back in the 1960s. But since 2013, people in the South lost at least 1,200 polling stations. According to a study by the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the Supreme Court decision to invalidate part of the Voting Rights Act 7 years ago contributed to the closures. In Texas, the state closed 750 polling stations, more than any other state, as part of a statewide effort to create centralized voting centers. Lawmakers argued the voting centers would make voting easier and eliminate the potential confusion of precinct-specific voting. But the irony is, efforts to centralize voting may instead be disproportionately keeping people of color from the polls. Research from the University of Houston shows Latino neighborhoods lost more polling stations than majority white communities, and this is forcing people to travel further to vote. Brandon Rottinghouse has been keeping track of these closures and their impact. He's a political science professor at the University of Houston. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mirna Perez is also with us. She directs the Brennan Center's Voting Rights and Elections Program. Mirna, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mirna, how did the 2013 Shelby County versus Holder Supreme Court decision change the Voting Rights Act?
The Voting Rights Act was the country's most impactful piece of civil rights legislation. It is largely responsible for much of the gains that we have seen in terms of making our democracy more inclusive and representative. The Supreme Court decision in Shelby County dramatically enfeebled it by weakening one of its core provisions. And that provision was Section 5, sometimes called the preclearance provision, which said that if you were a jurisdiction that had an egregious history of racial discrimination in voting, you were not allowed to make an election change unless you could certify in advance that any change you wanted to make was not going to make minority voters worse off or was not done with the hopes of making minority voters worse off. And you can imagine the kind of deterrent effect and the way that it would stop discrimination before it actually happened. When the Supreme Court decision through the Shelby County case enfeebled Section 5, we saw a wave of restrictive legislation across the country whereby states that would have prior had to defend any action before they could implement it was suddenly able to do it. One of the big instances, which I know we're going to talk about, is in the state of Texas, which had attempted to pass the country's strictest, most onerous photo identification requirement, but was actually blocked by Section 5. And when the Shelby County decision came out, within moments, the Attorney General announced that they were moving forward with their photo ID law. I was one of the lawyers that litigated against that case, and that we were in court for 5-6 years trying to undo the damage that Shelby County had done.
How quickly would you say things went to pass as soon as that decision went?
It basically took a legislative cycle for those places that had legislative options. And so in a place like North Carolina, that was super quick, right? North Carolina was in the midst of a legislative cycle when the Shelby County decision came down. And its legislators were on record saying before Shelby County, they were just going to try and pass a photo ID law. But once the Shelby County decision happened, they decided to go for the whole enchilada. And they passed an omnibus draconian anti-voter law that, again, had to get challenged in court separately. And a lot of damage was done under it. So it was almost immediate. It just depended upon where in the process the particular law at issue was. So in the case of Texas, it had been passed long before and now it was allowed to go into effect. In the case of North Carolina, it was serving as a bulwark to stop a bad law. And once it was no longer there as a barrier, they went forward with it.
So, Brandon, what's Texas trying to do with these voting centers, and why are they closing so many polling stations?
Well, the goal of the voting centers was effectively to make it cheaper to run elections and make it easier for people to vote. One of the things that we find is that it makes it easier for people to vote, but typically for people who are already voters to vote. It's not good at expanding the electorate, which in a place like Texas, where we have so many young voters and so many new voters, it makes it a challenge. The goal was eventually to be able to develop this election machinery that let more people vote. It's tended to be the case that it has been effective for some, but not for others. Some of the research that we've done shows that in the counties that have implemented it, that it has been either a net neutral or in some cases a net negative. It has been a bit of a bump in some of the election cycles that we have where you've got a low information turnout, but not a significant one.
So if I understand you correctly, these centers, they work towards getting existing voters to come in, but they don't actually encourage new voters to cast ballots. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what we're theorizing, and some of the data set tend to play that out. The kind of logic behind that is that we have seen the polling places in the communities and in the counties that are changing to this vote center model remove polling places from areas where there's more density of ethnic and racial minorities. And as a result, not surprisingly, they don't turn out in as big a numbers. So that's a real challenge for the state. This is an obvious sort of connection to literature and political science, which suggests that if you take people out of those communities, if you change people's patterns of voting, if you disrupt the neighborhood connection to a particular issue or a particular community or group, then it tends to reduce turnout.
And so, there's also a connection to this with the Shelby County decision, because that kind of consolidation and closing of polling locations is exactly the kind of thing that Texas would have had to prove in advance before doing it, that it was not going to make minority voters worse off. So it not only would prevent someone who was intentionally trying to make minority voters worse off, it also would have caught up the bad planning. There was a really long lines that happened in Arizona after the Shelby County decision, and folks think that nobody was intending. They just weren't properly assessing how the change was going to impact people, and had they just thought about it a little bit more, they would have been able to compensate for it better. And so without Shelby County, we have suppression that is both intentional and accidental, because they're not being tested on it the way that they would have if we'd had Section 5.
So Brandon, Texas was part of Super Tuesday primaries yesterday. Were these voting centers effective? Did it make it easier for people to vote?
I think the consensus is that it's making it longer for people to vote. So long line signals enthusiasm, which is great. But long lines also show that the time it takes to vote is increasing, and it's becoming a bit of a problem. If you increase the lines, it decreases the likelihood people are going to turn out to vote. But this is becoming more of a trend. This kind of vote center is going to be the way of the future for Texas. And if they can't solve these issues with respect to waiting, then it could be a serious disenfranchisement problem.
Brandon Rodinghouse is a political science professor at the University of Houston, and Myrna Perez is director of the Brennan Center's Voting Rights and Elections Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.